It's a great pleasure to be able to address you today. For me, commencement is both a celebration and a time for reflection. All of us here who are sharing with you pride in what you've accomplished and also anticipation about what comes next. At whatever stage you are in your career, either as a young adult who is earning a first degree or a certificate, or someone well advanced in their chosen profession, I dare say that not one of you sees this as the final accomplishment of your life, and that everything from here on out is on the downhill slide. You're still writing your story. You're still finding your place in history. We are, each of us, individually and collectively, creatures of history, though perhaps we live in a time where it seems much more important to talk about where we're going than where we've been. But I guess what I want to share with you is my belief that knowing more about our past helps us better understand and define who we see ourselves to be, how we fit in our own time and place. And to show you what I mean, I want to take you back to Juneau 100 years ago, because Juneau is the commonality that we share today, even though many of us call other places home. And I focus on the year 1912, in part because centennials are increments of time that we frequently used to celebrate achievement. I suspect also generally we do it because there are few eyewitnesses who can contradict anything we assert about the time. In many respects, that Juneau and the world it inhabited is much more recognizable than you might at first think. But in others, it belongs to a different universe. In 1912, Juneau was the actual seat of the territorial government for 6 years at that point. It wasn't the largest town in Alaska. Fairbanks was more than twice the size of Juneau. And Nome, even though its population was dwindling, still had 600 more residents than Juneau. But between Juneau, Douglas, and Treadwell, there were more than 5,000 people who lived in the district. In its first years, Juneau wasn't much more than a mining town, but by 1912, it had taken on an aura of permanence. Many of Juneau's most prominent buildings downtown were under construction, the Stalker, the Kane Hotel, the Goldstein buildings, all standing today. And when Mayor Emery Valentine announced that he was going to put a building at the corner of Seward and Front Streets, it was called the first fireproof building in Alaska. And there were other signs of progress as well. The streets of Juneau were to be illuminated by even more powerful lights so that it would light up the night like the major cities of the West Coast. And Juneau readily accessed the outside world. It was connected by underwater cable and wireless service, but not of the internet kind. It boasted a telephone exchange. You could dial one if you don't feel right and you can't get your mind on your work, take a big drink of sparkling delicious soda water. Or so advertised the Alaska Soda Bottling Company. Motorcycles were in high demand even as the city planned a road extension to Sheep Creek. And businessmen were urged to underwrite an aviator to do an exhibition flight over Juneau. Pilots then were either called birdmen or aeroplanists. Juneau also had a very active social society, equal parts church, dance, and theater. Social clubs put on balls. The Elks had its hard luck ball. Theaters would offer moving pictures and vaudeville. Smokers were held for numbers of single men. And smokers means exactly that, gatherings of young single men. presumably some smoking as well. The governor received visitors in an open house at his residence in the new year, and by the end of that year, he would occupy a new mansion. On Christmas, one of the 2 days of the year that the mines were closed, a match was held between Juno and Treadwell soccer teams. And the Treadwell Club boasted a library of 15,000 volumes, including periodicals in 12 different languages. Bart Thane and B.M. Behrens declared that it was time for a public library in Juneau. Mining was king, and it dominated local life. Most able-bodied men worked in the Treadwell complex or in the Alaska Gastineau or the Alaska Juneau mining operations. There was a national commentator who waxed eloquently about Alaska's great future, calling it the great industrial empire of the future. And if, as to underscore that point, drillers began and completed a 7,200-foot tunnel between the Silver Bowl Basin and Gastineau Channel for a stamp mill that would be the largest ore crushing complex in the world. And a massive power plant was undertaken at Nugget Creek to help power the Treadwell. Some things you again will perhaps recognize today in response to cries of a critical housing shortage in Juneau. The City Council announced plans to fill in the tide flats for additional housing. Public health was overseen by a federal health and marine hospital service, which had to contend with tuberculosis in Alaska and scarlet fever in Douglas. Juneau wasn't an isolated place. Its daily news linked it to the goings-on throughout Alaska and the Yukon. Reports covered not only major activities in the northern settlements, but the detailed itineraries of Alaskans and Yukoners as they traveled to the lower, what we'd call the lower 48 or the lower states. Relationships had been forged throughout the region, and commerce was highly integrated. Not just miners and merchants, but government itself was itinerant. Locals followed the upheavals in China, in Mexico, and Europe, especially Europe. For many, it was personal. When the first Balkan War pitted the Balkan League against the Ottoman Empire in October of 1912, 51 men from the local Greek community immediately left to fight for their homeland. And 10 days later, 100 Herzegovinians joined them. There were issues on the national scene that impacted Alaska as well. President Taft promised that in his second term, if he were elected, he would recommend laws that would reverse the Alaska land withdrawals, including the Tongass that his predecessor, Theodore Roosevelt, had undertaken. Congress began to debate an immigration reform law. But above all else, the locals followed the efforts of their lone non-voting delegate to Congress, James Wickersham, as he worked to build a coalition to grant home rule for the territory. It wouldn't be an easy task because, as Mayor Valentine observed, any legislation that will not directly benefit the Guggenheims and the other foreign corporations doing business in Alaska is not going to have fair sailing if they can prevent it. Valentine was referring to the Alaska Syndicate, owned largely by Guggenheim and J.P. Morgan interests, which controlled the transportation, most of the mining, and increasingly the canned salmon industry within Alaska. Indeed, the irreparable rift between Taft and Roosevelt was triggered in part by the Ballinger affair, in which Taft's first Secretary of Interior had been accused of granting special privileges in Alaska coal lands to the syndicate. And this was really part of a wider national debate that was captured in this headline: coterie of 100 men control the money affairs of the nation. Fewer than 30,000 direct the wealth of this country. It was their version of the 1%. Working conditions and mine safety were raw subjects. The Treadwell had been the site of labor unrest on several occasions. 5 years before, strikebreakers were finally brought into the Juneau area to restore labor peace. And fishermen had struck the canned salmon industry for better prices, but the temporary truce that had been reached only bought time for the canneries to dramatically expand the use of fish traps into every bay in southeast Alaska in order to eliminate their dependency on the fishing fleet. Despite the opposition of the Taft administration, the Home Rule Bill passed Congress, though it came with a heavy price extracted by the Alaska Syndicate and its allies. There would be a properly elected Alaska legislature, but it would be barred from management of lands or fish and game. It could not build or maintain roads. It had a limited power to tax, could not regulate gambling, liquor, or divorce. It could not borrow money. But it was the first step towards home rule, and citizens embraced it with a passion. Three territorial parties vied for a voice in the new legislature that fall: the progressives, the nonpartisans, and the socialists. And after extensive public debate, each announced platforms that were striking in their similarity: suffrage for women and the abolition of the fish traps, though as I noted, in the latter case, the new legislature would be powerless to act. To this, the nonpartisans added the 8-hour working day. At that point, a miner worked 10 hours a day, and if you were in the mill, you worked 12 hours a day. Protections of the lives of mine employees and what they called working men's compensation. And when the legislature convened in early 1913, these were among the measures they passed. But if women were on the verge of obtaining the franchise, persons of Chinese or Japanese descent, and most Alaska Natives who made up half of Alaska's population, were not. But a political movement, which was instigated by a publication called The Tlinkit at Sheldon Jackson College, appeared late that previous year, and it called for the rights of Alaska Natives to vote. Gathering in Juneau before the November elections, Alaska Natives formed their own organization, the Alaska Native Brotherhood. On the floor of the convention, Peter Simpson, who was a millwright from Sitka, eloquently spoke of its goals. "We want citizenship because we have had a taste of education and we want more. We want to own land. Once we decided to take up a sawmill site, we paid our fees. It cost us $700 to try to get the mill site. Yet we couldn't hold it because we were not American citizens. We want to help make the laws under which we live." Simpson was elected ANB's first president. As 1912 came to a close, the editor of the Dispatch, reflecting over the events of the year, mused to his readers, "It is one of the peculiarities of human nature that we seldom realize that we are making history. From our vantage point, we can see that history and some of the common threads that link us across time. Alaska's desire for a greater voice in governance, the battle against the influence of outside interests for management and control of natural resources, the struggle of peoples, especially in their own land, to achieve equal dignity and recognition within our society." One of America's great contemporary historians, David McCullough, once reflected on his approach to writing history. And he wrote, It is of utmost importance to convey the sense that things need not have happened the way they did. Life in other times past were never on a track any more than it is now or ever will be. The past, after all, is only another name for someone else's presence. How would things turn out? They knew no better than we know how things will turn out for us. Yet he was particularly taken by the extent to which the little-known events of a given time and people who are not in the headlines can be what matter most in the long run. And as he would say, in the long run is the measure of history. We are, all of us, beneficiaries of the long run. We are the tradition bearers for the generations in each of our families who live their stories and who collectively account for this place called Alaska. And while there are some few who stand out, who we are today is largely the result of many individuals who gained a foothold here over generations, some more conscious than others of their role in making history. And when McCullough writes about the people who are not in the headlines, he's acknowledging that humans live in community, that every person plays a role in shaping the conditions that surround them. Whether you're in diesel technology or teaching, construction or chemistry, the certificates and degrees you receive today are your special license to help shape contemporary society. The purpose of your education is not driven simply to advance the interests of each of you individually, but to benefit the society of which you are a part. In June 1966, Senator Robert Kennedy embarked on a trip to South Africa. He had been invited by the National Union of South African Students, and while he received a visa, the white minority government had refused to meet with him, largely because of his outspoken criticism of apartheid. Nevertheless, he was greeted enthusiastically everywhere he went. And at Cape Town, he delivered what many regard as his greatest speech, an appeal to the young people of South Africa to take charge of their future. One passage especially resonated with me today, and I share it with you. Few will have the greatness to bend history, but each of us can work to change a small portion of the events. And in the total of all these acts will be written the history of this generation. His remarks were certainly prophetic. That generation did indeed change South Africa. But I think more importantly, his words are descriptive. It is the countless acts of people not in the headlines who shape the long run, who bend history. And as you go from this convention, seek out the challenges of your time. Find one thing to do better. Use your talents. Become engaged with your community, wherever it is. Make a difference. There's the story of the Irishman who comes across a street brawl and shouts out, "Is this a private fight or can anyone join in?" And without waiting for reply, he wades in swinging. Be that Irishman. Wade in swinging. Bend history. Thank you.